I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Our guest this hour is a historian of crime and punishment. She's been inside of America's prisons and has documented severe abuses that have taken place within them. Heather Ann Thompson is an associate professor of African American Studies and History at Temple University. She's the author of Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy, which won the 2017 Pulitzer Prize for History. She's written a piece for City Lab in which she documents, and I want to start with these numbers, which are just phenomenal. There are 2.3 million people behind bars, she writes, 1,719 state prisons, 102 federal prisons, 901 juvenile correctional facilities, 3,163 local jails, 76 Indian country jails, as well as military prisons, immigration detention facilities, civil commitment centers, and prisons in the U.S. territories. We physically contain more human beings than any other country in the world, and the conditions in many of those prisons are terrible. That's what we talk about this hour of the program. Our phone number for you to join the conversation with Heather Ann Thompson is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Professor Thompson, thanks so much for being with us. Hi.
Oh, great to be here.
Those numbers are just astounding. Why do we have so many people behind bars in this country?
Well, certainly not because we have more crime. We made a policy choice basically 40 years ago to start dealing with social dissent and start dealing with many critical social problems through the criminal justice system rather than through, you know, other systems such as public health or education. And we made a policy choice that we have really just added to and lived with over the last 40 years to really add up to a crisis that means we are an international outlier, more people locked up, more people with criminal records, more people, more communities really ravaged by this policy response than any other country.
You write about Sweden and Norway in your article, saying their primary goal of prison is to return people to the society improved. Do we have a stated goal of what the purpose of prison is in America?
Well, that's one of the problems. I think that if you just simply talk to most Americans, people are deeply conflicted about what the goal of our criminal justice system is. Certainly through very distinct periods in American history, we thought of it as rehabilitative. In other moments, we thought about it as punitive. But one of the undergirding principles of this new run-up in the prisons has been punitive only. In other words, taking away the elements within prisons that might be rehabilitative, you know, making sure that prisoners don't get college educations, making sure that they spend way too much time in solitary confinement, which, of course, damages people mentally, physically. So even though there's no real stated purpose, at least not one that's agreed upon, certainly what we've done has been in the punitive vein, not the rehabilitative or, you know, returning folks back home model.
You have been inside of the country's prisons. You've documented severe abuses that have taken place. And yet the public really doesn't know much about what's going on in prisons because there's such little access to all of these institutions. Why is that? And what did you find when you got in, and how did you get in?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, one of the reasons why I did the piece that that you mentioned in your opener is because it really just began to strike me the more research I did. I'm a historian, so the book I wrote on Attica was about a historical prison uprising in 1971, and then it's kind of 40-year fallout. But in the process of doing that book, I started to work much more on contemporary issues of incarceration, you know, again, trying to really document and explain how we ended up in this mess. And the more digging I did, both historically in Attica and also contemporaneously, it became clear it was almost impossible to find out basic information. You know, I also served on a federal commission where we studied the causes and consequences of incarceration, and, you know, much of the data we wanted was very difficult to find. You know, basic things like, you know, how many days of solitary confinement do American prisoners do on average? You know, this kind of data we don't have access to. And it struck me that this is really outrageous. These are public institutions that we fund and that we have a great deal of faith in, and yet we don't have a clue what happens inside of them. So to the extent I've had access, it's been, you know, really interesting. It's been sort of in spite of the barriers. In the case of Attica, I was barred from getting in when I was doing my book, but ultimately a corrections officer on the inside made it possible for me to get in. And, for example, at Greaterford Prison, where I've been inside, this is because there's a relationship. When I was at, I'm actually at Michigan now, but when I was at Temple, they had an educational program there called Inside Out that allowed me in. But in general, you as a citizen cannot just go into a prison, nor can even a state senator just walk up and say, I want to see this place. I want to see what goes on in my name.
Mm-hmm. And yet, tax dollars, we're funding prisons. We're spending a whole lot of money on prisons, aren't
we? Billions of dollars that, and this is really what's key, that we have faith are making us safer, are making our nation stronger. And that faith is critical, right? Because that means that we're giving that money to that particular policy and not funding others, such as building more schools or expanding Medicaid or Medicare, right? So these are choices that have huge implications, and we've been going about it completely backward. But you know, if it worked, we wouldn't know it. And actually, the digging we've done shows that it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a little bit of history here, because you are a historian. You write about this long history of the public being kept away from prisons. So you write, corrections officials could run them as they wished. For much of the 19th and into the 20th century, state politicians had a deeply ingrained fear of federal encroachment on their power, more generally translated into the hands of doctrine. Prison authorities had the right to do what they wanted to those who were in their charge. Does that fear of federal authority continue?
Well, it's funny. I mean, I think for the second half of the 20th century, that was probably a lot less true, but we do seem to have come back there. This real emphasis on states' rights has had a real resurgence. Suspicion of federal intervention. And again, that matters. For example, when President Obama took some quite bold steps to say, for example, that we would not have juvenile solitary confinement in federal prisons, or that we would address the ravages of the drug war in federal prisons, that was a really great step forward. But plenty of state prisons said, okay, but you know what? You have no authority on what we do. And so, of course, at the state level, things have continued pretty shabbily, including having, you know, juveniles serving solitary confinement and so forth. So there is a sense in which state autonomy has been deadly for the operation of prisons, because it's meant we have no idea how they're being run, and there's very little oversight, or not enough oversight.
You have covered uprisings in prisons and won a Pulitzer for your book on Attica. You mentioned and I don't think these received a whole lot of attention, recent uprisings, prisoners at facilities all over the country in 2016, having protests for better conditions, March and April of 2017, prisons in Delaware and Tennessee similarly exploded. Over what?
Exactly the same things that prisons have always had. Rebellions over. So things that are quite fundamental and basic. Enough food to eat, too many bodies placed in smaller spaces, so overcrowding, lack of basic humane medical care, abuses that happen to prisoners. You know, a recent story in Florida, you know, mentally ill prisoner who's scalded to death in a shower, and basically nothing happens to the guards responsible. These incidents lead ultimately to enormous frustration and have led to a whole series of prison uprisings on the anniversary of the Attica uprising last year in 2016 and some since. And, you know, you mentioned, well, we didn't know much about them. Well, again, this goes to the heart of my point, which is we don't know about them because when they happen, the corrections officials fully control the information coming out of them. And that's why the history matters, because at Attica, the same thing happened, and it took us 40 years to learn that, in fact, law enforcement killed 39 men in there and shot to death 128 others, and we would never have known all that because of the lockdown on information.
Mm. And we've had some high-profile cases, I'm sure you're aware of, in Milwaukee, a recent case where a mentally ill man was denied water and died of not being able to drink anything. I mean, that's horrendous.
Exactly.
Not given water for almost a week, and nobody paid attention to it. And also a juvenile facility, Lincoln Hills, which is based a little bit north, quite a bit north of Milwaukee, in a very white area with mostly African-American young people, severe abuse going on there for years.
Right. And I'm glad you mentioned, you know, Wisconsin and specifically Milwaukee, because I do think sometimes that there is this sense that, you know, maybe there are prison abuses that go on, but surely they must be happening in these backward areas of the Deep South, for example. I think we still kind of live with this mythology. And in fact, you know, Wisconsin and Michigan and Idaho and Maine and Vermont, and, you know, these places are not only, you know, not exempt from that terrible treatment, but in fact, the racial disparity of incarceration is worse in the North than it is in the South. And so that kind of abuse falls even more disproportionately on black and brown prisoners than white in states like Wisconsin, for example, than states like Alabama. So, you know, it's a lot to think about, and we just don't get to think about it because we're not let in.
Mm-hmm. Professor, what about the Freedom of Information Act, being able to use that to get access to prisons? It seems as though we can't even document all of this tremendous suffering unless people, journalists particularly, are allowed inside the prisons to talk to the prisoners, to talk to the guards.
Right. Well, a lot. I do chronicle a little bit of the ins and outs of that in the piece that I wrote, but the upshot of it is that to the extent we know anything, it is because they're first of all, the people inside are human beings, and so they don't stay silent. They do continue to keep talking, and they send letters to the outside, and they do, thank goodness, bring some attention on the inside. And, of course, we have social service agencies that are constantly pushing at the doors to get in, and we have journalists that are pushing at the doors to get in. But there's no easy legal mechanism by which we can simply demand the information. The closest approximation is the Freedom of Information Act. But my own experience with trying to use it is that all that they have to say in response is that it is a security issue, or, you know, in the case of past events, that it's grand jury testimony, so therefore it's private. And so basically you get shut down at every time. And virtually everything can be redacted in those reports based on security issues, alleged, not necessarily even proven, just alleged. And so even our basic legal means to access information as the public gets kind of clamped down before it really nets much information.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to this Sweden and Norway, much more transparency, and even special officers, you remind us of, who monitor and help advance progress toward return to the world outside. The vast majority of prisoners will be returned to the world outside. I can remember the days when we talked about rehabilitation programs, learning programs, schools inside many of our prisons in this country. Are there still any of those? Do we know if rehabilitation is taking place?
Yes. And so, you know, as is one of the downsides of state, a great deal of state discretion is the abuse and the lack of regulation. The upside is that, of course, that's not universally true, right? Some states are better than others. Some states have more attention to reentry and rehabilitation than others. And of course, a lot of this depends on the outside. So there's plenty of places where, American Friends Service Committee or various social service agencies are in fact going into prisons. And the Bard Prison Initiative is, Bard University sends teachers and make sure that folks on the inside get education. So there are education programs, there are some job training programs, there are some reentry services, and it's really important to shout those out and to make clear that people are trying to open these walls and kind of bridge this gap between imprisonment and freedom. But by and large it's run as charities are run, right? Which is on a great deal of volunteerism, a great deal of goodwill, and not a systematic commitment of officials, or at least not as it should be.
Let's welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Professor Heather Ann Thompson. She's a professor of African American Studies and History. Are you at Michigan State?
No, I'm at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor now, full professor there.
Thank you. She is a professor at the University of Michigan, and she is author of Blood in the Water, the Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. It won the 2017 Pulitzer Prize for History. Let's go to you. Do we need more transparency? Do you have a sense of what's going on inside our prisons? Do we need more of that? Some of you, I'm sure, listening have spent some time. We had some people with us a couple weeks ago who spent time inside prisons or were outlining some of the conditions in the Milwaukee area. But it's a lot of money, and there are a lot of people in prison in this country, a huge number, more than any other country on earth. Do we need to examine that as well? Are there people in prison, we'll ask our guest, who perhaps would be better served to be somewhere else? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter @KDunnShow. This is The Ideas Network. All right, let's go to phone calls now. Emily in Waukesha is our first caller. Hi, Emily.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Go right ahead.
Oh, yeah, I was just calling in because I'm a former corrections officer up until recently.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just, some of the comments that they are making are true. I know prison systems and jail systems are completely separate from another. And some of the stuff she is talking about is true, but there's also, a huge other side to corrections and jails and things like that I don't think are being discussed, like mostly how the corrections officers are treated,
mm-hmm.
and how some inmates are. Like, so I heard there's like huge emphasis on programs and education for these individuals. And from little experience I did have, it was a lot of people that didn't want treatment. They didn't want certain things. And I guess that kind of overlapped. A lot of people were trying to do good things there.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel that some of the conditions that we've talked about created a situation inside the prison where you felt unsafe, that there was a lot of pent-up anger among prisoners that was taken out on you and other officers?
From being a female, every day was, in my personal opinion, a struggle. It was a constant battle trying to be positive, be helpful, be consistent. It was very, very hard.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I made it about 3 months total, and I had to kind of hang up my boots there.
Hmm.
But it was constant verbal abuse. Physical abuse wasn't too much of an issue. It was a lot more bark than bite, but just the atmosphere, the way these people are allowed to treat other people, it was very difficult.
I am so glad that you've raised this, and thank you so much for calling in. This is Heather Thompson, and the reason I'm so glad you're bringing this up is actually, even though the conversation we've had so far have really been focusing on the prisoners inside, the work I do actually focuses a lot on the guards as well, and in fact the book on Attica is as much about the mistreatment that happened to guards as it is that happened to the prisoners. The point that I'm making about the openness of prisons or the need for accessibility to them is actually very much for guards as well. One of the reasons why prisons are such terrible places is because they are closed institutions. So guards are put in terrible situations where these prisons are so overcrowded, they don't have enough support. They are often fearful. They are often, in charge of people who have been, caged for so long and with so little time out and with such, bad relationships with one another and with the staff, that this is a horrible place for all concerned. And one of the things that we know from other countries where these walls are less solid, in other words, where there's more public access, that guard conditions are much, much better too. Corrections officers have safer workplaces. They feel more supported. The hostility coming towards them from the prisoners and vice versa is reduced dramatically. And so I'm so grateful you called in, because I would be absolutely remiss not to bring that to the fore as well.
Can we talk just a little bit before we go back to calls about solitary confinement, how often it is used, when it may be necessary to use solitary confinement, and the impact it has on prisoners, particularly juveniles?
Well, I mean, first of all, I just have to say about solitary that there is no justification, and every other human rights organization on the globe has taken the position that solitary confinement, particularly the way it is used in excess and with minors and with vulnerable populations, is cruel and unusual punishment. That has been decided a long time ago. Charles Dickens knew it when he visited American prisons in the 19th century. Medical professionals know it today. Corrections professionals know it today. But when you have very overcrowded facilities and guards are corrections officers are in these terrible situations, solitary becomes a go-to way to deal with bad behavior and stressful, tense situations on a tier. And so, there's no question that it is bad for people, and there's no question that it makes people angrier and exacerbates mental illness. We know it. It's indisputable. But because of the way prisons are allowed to run and because they are so overcrowded, it is the go-to way to deal with crisis situations.
Let's go to Mary in Milwaukee next. Hi, Mary.
Hello. Well, I have a comment and a question. And my comment is that they do need to be more transparent. And the wardens, the heads of the DOCs, these are all taxpayer positions.
Yes.
That are paid for by we the taxpayers, we the people. And we should have the right to know what's going on. There should be more transparency. And I'm just wondering, do we still have prison review boards?
Well, we do, but again, this is where it's very catch-can. It really depends on the state. It depends on the district. Jails and state prisons are very different depending on the place, and, of course, that's different from federal prison. And, to the extent that we have review boards and to the extent that they are helpful, they have managed to net some real access. But in general, we don't know about what has gone wrong in a prison until someone dies, a guard is killed, a prisoner is killed, someone is injured, and there is some kind of litigation that follows it. Or, in the case of Attica Prison recently, there was a horrendous beating of a prisoner, a guy named George Williams. And the reason why we ultimately knew what happened was because of a nurse, a medical professional in that facility, who she was given this guy after he'd been so badly beaten by this group of guards, and she refused to just admit him into the prison hospital. She said he needs to go to the main hospital. So we find out about these things after the crisis moment.
Thanks, Mary, very much for your call. Tim in Altoona, hi.
Hi, I'm wondering what sort of parallels could be made between slavery or indentured servitude and life in prison. I understand that even when they do have jobs, that these jobs are paid pennies and the money does not go very far in the commissary and that sort of thing. And I know there were just under 4 million slaves in the U.S. at the end of, or in 1860. So how many people do we have in prison? How many people, where are these parallels?
Well, I think there's a lot of parallels. Some of it's really helpful to think about in tandem, and some of it I'm afraid is not. What's helpful to understand is that, yes, we do have, as part of our Constitution, an exception to the rule on slavery, which is the 13th Amendment, which basically says We can't have slavery in this country except for if you've been convicted of a crime. This is a holdover of yesteryear, and it means that people in prison can be forced to labor, and they can be paid very, very little. And those jobs do, in fact, you know, go from the outside world into prisons, and they dampen wages on the outside. So that's a real problem. And the other parallel with slavery is that just like back after slavery, when we, you know, had lots of people in prison for very petty crimes and took away their right to vote, we now have also disfranchised everybody in prison and taken away their right to vote by a very tortured reading of the 14th Amendment. So there are some parallels. But on the other hand, it's in some respects, I'm not sure it helps us to go there all the time, because we have so many ways in which we have protections for the human beings in prison that we simply need to enforce now, and we simply need to shine the light on so that we do not just kind of dismiss them as, well, I guess the law says we can treat them like slaves. There are many, many human rights that they have already won in the 60s that we simply need to enforce.
Mm. When and where, this is something that makes you cringe, were the prisoners who cut their
Achilles tendon,
so they wouldn't have to work in the cotton fields?
Well, this was, of course, across the South. Many of the Southern prisons right after the Civil War were, in fact, plantations, just reconfigured as prisons. And the conditions were so brutal that sometimes people would maim themselves rather than be subjected to that level of forced labor. And so that's another part of our history. But again, when did we learn about that even? We didn't learn about the horrors going on in these prison plantations until a guy named Tom Merton, a prison reformer, was sent in to kind of shine the light and figure out what was going on. And he became a whistleblower, basically. There was an 80s movie made on his story called Brubaker with Robert Redford. And again, it just underscores we only know about these institutions when somebody kind of gets in there despite the rules, you know, through the back door, for sure.
Thanks, Tim, for your call. Ed in West Dallas, hi.
Well, congratulations on your Pulitzer.
Oh, thank you.
If not prison, what? Let me throw out a name. Winston Moss. The Katie Genovese case in March of 1964, Kew Gardens in Queens. She was stabbed over 28 times.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody came to her rescue. I guess one person did. We learned that from a new documentary.
Mm-hmm.
We have Richard Speck, Michael Harrington, Jeffrey Dahmer. What are you going to do with these people?
Well, that's such an important question, and believe it or not, there's a lot of good answers to that. So you're actually kind of, I think, asking two questions. One of them is, or maybe I am, one of them is, what do we do with the prisons we have, and then what do we do, what would we do maybe instead of prison, or what would we do with people who we believe should be in prison? My article is really arguing that if we're going to have the prisons that we have to have more porous access to them because of just what the corrections officer said who called in. These places are run like secret societies, and a lot of terrible things happen in them. And even if someone gets sentenced for a crime, even a horrific crime, they are sentenced to time, and they are sentenced to be removed from society, but they are not a sentence to torture and abuse. So we want accessibility. Then there's the question of, is everybody in prison? Should they all be there?
Mm-hmm.
I think certainly folks are coming to feel like petty drug crimes, the extraordinary number of people are in there for mental illness and addiction should not be there. But then what about the cases you mentioned? And again, I think that there's lots of interesting examples from other countries that, you know, people are in fact removed from society, or they are dealt with through numbers of different kinds of programs, restorative justice programs, community confinement, even prisons. But they're run more humanely than ours are. And so it's just a question of access more than anything.
So I don't know if this is a fair question, but when you say there are 2.3 million people behind bars, do you have any idea how many people should be behind bars, where that number should be?
Well, I can tell you this. We have never had this many people in prison ever. ever. And in fact, we started a war on crime when the murder rate had not been that low since 1910. So the reason we have so many people in prison is not because of the cases that this gentleman brings to the fore. Yes, some people are in prison for murder, and some people are in prison for some pretty horrific crimes. But I think that people would be pretty shocked if you looked at the data. I mean, the majority of women in federal prison are there for nonviolent property-type related crimes, drug-related crimes. The majority of people are not there because they are serial killers. The Jeffrey Dahmers make up such an infinitesimal percentage of all the murders committed. So, you know, I think what this gentleman is raising is, well, what do we do about those people? And I think we should have those discussions. But what I'm suggesting is we're talking about scores and scores of people that don't remotely fit that profile who are being abused in prison today. And we need to talk about that, too.
Ivy in Evansville. Hi.
Hi. I wonder if your research followed the money. I've been recently aware of the prisons, the private prisons, for example, in New Jersey, that take in illegal immigrants and how they make money per bed, and they hold them for long periods of time. And also, there was a case in Pennsylvania where juveniles were put in prison for really minor offenses, and a judge was getting huge kickbacks for it. So there's money to be made on prisons, and
absolutely,
that concerns me. So I was wondering if you could address that.
Yes, I'm so glad that you raised that, because part of this issue of accountability is about the money, and we don't know. So here's the sad answer to your question. I mean, we know that private prisons only make up about 7% of all facilities, and that's not that much, unless you're talking about immigration detention facilities, and then that number is much, much higher. But we don't know exactly what's going on with the money, because, again, this is to do with the secrecy. Nobody has to account for anything. So there is not just the private prisons, which are actually a smaller percentage. The real issue is all the servicing of prisons. So that's the telephones and the tasers and the laundry services and the medical transport and the filling of the beds, like you just mentioned. You know, prisons, so that people are, you know, imprisoned in Hawaii but shipped to Minnesota because that's where the bed is. This is all a huge profit-making endeavor, which should also trouble us as citizens. There's nothing wrong with making a buck in America, but it is a problem if somebody is profiting off of other people's misery. It is a problem if someone is making money and has to kind of hope that somebody is murdered or raped or robbed, or has to hope that they get a 30-year sentence on a petty drug crime to make money. So why don't we know more about it? Well, because they literally don't have to tell us, and yet we, again, are paying for those exorbitant fees to, for example, bring in a private medical transport company to a Florida prison rather than hire state employees to do it, or private medical services. And, yeah, I mean, you're raising incredibly important questions. We need to know, and that's the whole point of the article.
Heather, has there been, I've read about some bipartisan concern about the cost of prisons and particularly efforts to get nonviolent offenders in places that are less expensive. Is that a growing movement in the country, and have there been any results that have changed prisons because there's a bipartisan concern?
Well, there certainly was, you know, prior to the recent presidential election, I certainly felt that I was, waist high in some really interesting bipartisan criminal justice reform efforts. There were many parties at the table. Some were there because prisons were too expensive. Some were there because they felt prisons were run immorally and, you know, unjustly. Some were there on behalf of prisoners, some were there on behalf of guards. We had a huge group of people working on criminal justice reform. I am deeply alarmed to say that, you know, our new Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, has pretty much rolled back the clock on that. He has said we are going to go fly in the face of all of our evidence that shows that locking this many people up destroys communities and doesn't make us safer. And he's now calling for more punitive law and order policies again. That's the failed policy that everyone who works on this knows is failed. So I don't know where we are now. I do know that on the ground, though, and that is in communities like Milwaukee and like Detroit, and I know that that movement to kind of help with reentry, integrate people back to the community has not gone away. When we have 100 million people almost in this country with a criminal justice record, we are now waking up to the fact that these are our neighbors. These are the children we teach in school. You know, these are the people we're working next to, and so it's just not going to go away.
100 million people.
Yeah, there's estimates between 70 and 100 million people now have a criminal justice record in this country.
Whew. Ivy, thanks for the call. Amy in Madison, hi.
Hi, I'm a long-time listener. Thank you so much. I used to live in Attica, actually.
And
I knew a guard there who told me the whole story because he was caught in the uprising and lived to tell his story about how much he resented Rockefeller and the National Guard and who really did what.
Mm-hmm.
While I was in Attica, of course, Mark David Chapman, who killed John Lennon, and Son of Sam Berkowitz both lived there, so I was down the road from them. It bugs me when white people use people like them, other white men like Dahmer and Speck, to justify the imprisonment of thousands upon thousands of black men who got caught in the system, got caught in nonviolent drug offenses, who have mental illness, who are basically in bad circumstances and, frankly, growing up in poverty. So as I looked at Attica and as I heard Curley's story, the guard, he told me that what they wanted was more than one roll of toilet paper a month,
yep,
pork removed from their diet, mm-hmm, more guards of color, more Spanish-speaking guards. They wanted pretty practical stuff, and they were denied. And then when the uprising happened, they were mowed down by the National Guard.
Yep.
It was a mess.
Yeah.
And it was because Rockefeller, in part, refused to go there.
That's true. And I appreciate your comment, because I think that at the end of the day, what we have to ask ourselves as a society is, what is the goal? You know, I know this is the way the program started off, is to kind of ask, what do Americans think the goal of prison is? And, you know, if the ultimate goal is to make a society safer, we are going about it the wrong way. If if you want people to return better than they went in, why would we want that? Because then they become our neighbors. They become our, these are our children. These are our neighbors. These are our students. And so if the goal is to make people better, we could not be going about this in a more backward way. And when people say, well, I'm not sure if that's the goal, maybe the goal is to punish, what I always suggest is to take it a little bit closer to home. We think about our own loved ones, and even if they committed the worst possible crime, I picture the person you love the most in your mind, and imagine finding out that they just committed the most heinous crime. Ask yourself, what would you want then to happen? You'd want them to take responsibility. You would maybe want them removed if they needed some help or needed some treatment or needed to just reflect, but you certainly wouldn't want them abused. And you certainly wouldn't want them tortured. And it's the closed nature of prisons that allows those abuses to go on.
Heather Ann Thompson is our guest this hour. She is a historian of crime and punishment. She's at the University of Michigan right now, and she is the winner, I haven't read this book, but I want to read it now, author of Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy, which won the 2017 Pulitzer Prize for History. She came to our attention because of a piece that she wrote for City Lab, and I think that we'll probably put that on her Facebook page in case you would like to read it. It is titled, Americans Must Demand Better Access to Prisons. We're welcoming phone calls. We've been very busy, but at this moment, you would be able to get through. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network. All right, back to phone calls for Heather, and we go to Richard in Madison next. Hi, Richard.
Good afternoon, Kathleen.
Good afternoon.
All right. I am a correctional officer in Wisconsin, and I agree with your guest that for petty crimes, some of the inmates should be, shouldn't even be there, should be released. But I also realize that for some inmates, such as sex offenders, I see these guys come in and out time and time again, over and over again. They do 3 or 4 years for the crime, and then they get out. We offer treatment. We offer psychologists, psychiatrists, medication, GPS tracking. We do quite a bit. And then they're repeat offenders, and they come back. And those are victims out there that they repeat, you know, that they offend time and time again. Mm-hmm. And then she talks about victimless crimes. Well, you know what? If you're a drug dealer and you sell someone some heroin and that person ODs, well, that's not a victimless crime, you know. And I would love to hear her comments, and I'll take it off the air.
Thanks, Richard. Thanks for your call.
Yeah, I mean, you're raising some really important issues. I mean, one of the hallmarks of our criminal justice system and its failures is that we have the highest recidivism rate in the world. And that tells us that what we are doing is not working. Again, you know, I bring us back to that question of what do we want to happen, and whether we are, you know, my family has got folks in law enforcement as well as folks on the inside. So I definitely hear what your caller is saying. But, you know, we just have to remember, if the goal is to make us all safer, then this isn't working, and we need to know why. We need to know what is happening on the inside and what is happening on the outside that we have the world's highest recidivism rate. So clearly, if we have a sex offender that is rotating in and out through the system, it is breaking down. It is not doing what we want it to do. And similarly with this question of victimless crimes, there is no question that drug addiction is a scourge. There's no question that we have serious, serious problems with the way in which, you know, addicts and heroin, the heroin epidemic is destroying communities and families. But what we know is that we're not solving it through the criminal justice system. We are only going to solve this if we start to look at root causes. So, you know, I could not agree more that this is a problem, and it's deeply frustrating for those on the inside who work there and who, you know, serve time there to see this revolving door. So it's not working. So we've got to get some access to figure out why.
And another area where we really need to figure out what is a better way is treating people with mental illness. There are so many encounters with the police, and I've talked to many officers who are dealing with mental illness all the time, and there aren't facilities to treat this. There are cases, we did a show on de-escalation yesterday, and the number of cases where officers have encountered people who are, you know, singing songs and not clothed on a street corner and acting strange, and the police are called. And unfortunately, we've seen some horrible outcomes of those kinds of encounters. But the police are also saying, what are we to do?
Well, that's right. And that's why I really, you know, you've heard me say it a few times on the program. I mean, that's why I don't like to draw these kind of stark lines between you're either pro-prisoner or you're pro-corrections officer.
Yes.
The fact is that These are terrible situations that people get in, and corrections officers are being asked to be mental health professionals. They are being asked to be psychologists to deal with things like, you know, sex crimes. They're being asked to do things that's not their job. They're not trained to do it, and that the outcome of it is deeply frustrating for them and sometimes unsafe for them. Similarly, with prisoners, you know, when the jury sentences them and they are meant to go away and serve some time, they're not meant to be abused or mistreated, and many of them shouldn't be there, not because what they did was okay, but because they're not going to become better citizens where they got put. Now, as you point out, right, maybe they need a different kind of response.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I really think that we are all in this boat together, and I think that certainly my argument to have greater accessibility to prisons, it is for the greater society's benefit, and that includes the corrections officers, the police officers, and the prisoners themselves.
Greg and Racine, hi.
Hi. I think I would hope all civilized people would agree that prisoners should not be abused in any way. I just wonder if your guest feels like, to any extent, it's okay for some of this to be about plain and simple punishment. That when somebody does something wrong, and it's of some significance, that they deserve to experience at least the unpleasantness of being put in prison. I mean, that there is that the punitive nature of incarceration is okay, or is that something that you wish we would disconnect ourselves from? I'll take it off the air. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg.
That's a great question. I mean, I think that all civilized societies struggle with this question of what is what should happen when someone commits a harm against another, and what should happen when one violates a social norm or breaks a law or commits a harm against someone else. And I certainly won't make pronouncements on that, but I will say that, again, my emphasis is on what do we want the outcome to be. Even if one argues that punishment should be the goal, I prefer personally to use taking responsibility, and I think that that can have many, many different connotations and permutations. But if the goal is to make our society safer, then the problem with punishment is that there is a point of diminishing returns. If you torture someone, they become a more violent, a more angry, a more bitter, and a more dangerous person. And human beings have an incredible capacity to learn and an incredible capacity for remorse and an incredible capacity to remake themselves. We all know that because we see it in our children, we see it in ourselves. So, you know, even if we want punishment, we have to rethink the outcome that we really, really want on the other end.
Matt sends this email, Heather, until we remove the profitability from our prison system, nothing will change. As long as someone stands to profit, the status quo will survive and our incarceration rate will stay the same or increase.
Yes, I do think that that's certainly a concern, and I think that different states have different issues. I will actually be in Milwaukee on November 6th at Turner Hall doing a talk on this, so I really invite local folks to come and let's continue this conversation, because certainly in a state like Wisconsin, enormous public resources are going towards prisons, and they aren't going to other places, you know, like the state educational system. And so we are at this critical moment where, as voters and taxpayers, as one of your callers pointed out, when we have an obligation to kind of weigh in on this, I think.
We go to Joe in Chippewa Falls next. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, how are you?
Oh, I just got off my shift, so I caught this. So I worked in four facilities
here in
Wisconsin.
Oh, you
do? Oh. And I worked at Lincoln Hill.
Oh, you did?
I'm well acquainted with a lot of things. The one thing I want to bring up is we don't make any money in corrections. We are the number one drain on the state because we have so many people in, because now we're about to break the record for the amount of people ever incarcerated in the state of Wisconsin. A lot of the stuff that you're describing is true. It's mostly due to, you know, petty crimes, things like that. But what we have is what's called truth in sentencing, and this is coming from the people in Madison. Okay, when you commit a crime, you do the time. That's how it goes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we don't want all these people in, but unfortunately, with the way the legislature set it up and the current regime, that's how it is. I work in a program right now where you can get out in a short amount of time, but you have to go through a lot of programming. So I just want to pass that on. Found the show very interesting, and I'll get off the phone and let you go.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks for the call. We have about a minute left, Heather.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. At the end of the day, this is not about what's best for the society. It's about politics. And that's why the more we know, the more we can make rational policy.
Right. And we've been through so many different policies, haven't we? Through Dykes, you're out, truth in sentencing.
Yep.
You know, we swing from one end of the pendulum to the other, back and forth and back and forth.
Indeed. Well, thank you so much for inviting this conversation.
Thank you. And you'll be in Milwaukee November 6th.
That's right.
Turner Hall. All right. People will come and see you. Thank you so much, and congratulations on the Pulitzer.
Thank you so much.
Wonderful.
Take care.
Heather Ann Thompson, our guest this hour, she's now at the University of Michigan, where she is teaching about crime and jails and the criminal justice system and why we don't have access to what's going on in prisons in this country. She won the Pulitzer in 2017, this year, for Blood in the Water, the Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and its legacy. Thanks so much to Gretchen Brown for producing this interesting hour, and thanks to Colleen Leahy for on-air production and talking to many of you before you came on the air. And thanks for your phone calls. you are just such a valuable part of this program. What a wonderful hour this was to hear from people who are corrections officers and from people who understood Attica and understand this issue so thoroughly. Thank you for your calls and all of your wisdom as well. We have news coming up. Please stay with us for the second hour of the program. You'll enjoy it, and it's an important issue. Richard Florida will be joining us, author of The New Urban Crisis, How Our Cities Are Increasing Inequality, Deepening Segregation, and Failing the Middle Class, and What We Can Do About It.